So we'll get started again. See if we can digest this material after lunch, with our lunch. Thank you for all coming back. Are there any questions that kind of arose over lunch before we move on? We're going to really go into this in more detail in the next few slides, but if there's anything that wasn't clear that needs to be repeated, the ideas that came up at lunch. Okay, but we'll go on. Yes?
Are these charts ones that, you know, you've learned from, or are these charts that you created as part of your teaching process, or a combination of both? Or?
Yeah, a combination of both. So this mainly comes from what I learned from Andrew Alinsky, this particular framing, and there's different ways of framing this material. And I first encountered, I'm using a little bit different graphics, just the way my mind works, but very similar graphics from him. At, he has a wonderful retreat called Buddhist Psychology, Essentials of Buddhist Psychology. It's like 5 days. You have to fly to the other side of the country, but it's well worth it. And it just, you know, really goes into this in great detail. And so I've taken, like I said, 3 courses from him, and just over time I've taught various versions of that, including this is the Abhidhamma Dalam. I had a separate Buddhist Psychology Dalam where I created these slides. And I just found them a little bit, he kind of puts them, he has a big grease board and he writes them all in. It's just a little bit, I can't do that. My writing's not that good, so it's easier for me to make these PowerPoint slides. But there will be copies of a PDF copy of all of the slides that we'll post after this. So this is our stream of consciousness. Each mind moment is arising and passing away. That's kind of symbolized. Again, these aren't entities, but occurrences. These are transient events that are occurring, and they arise and pass away in each moment of time. So you can symbolize that whole triad consciousness by these little circles. So this is now a circle of consciousness that symbolizes those three things happening: the I, the organ, the object, and the consciousness that arises. But just to kind of simplify it, you know, we'll make it these little circles. So at each moment of time, there is the rising away of different things. And as these arrows indicate, they are influencing each other. So you see something, and in the next moment, maybe you have a thought about it. And this is all kind of condensed here, but what happens is, you know, very rapidly, we're having these multiple modalities of our experience that are occurring. Now it gets a little more complicated. So remember our 5 aggregates, you know, one mental factor, one physical factor, the form, and then all of these different 4 mental factors. Well, that's symbolized here. So with each moment, each one of these mind moments where we have the organ, the object, and the consciousness, all arising with that, you know, without doing anything, what happens in that same moment of time are these three things. You have the aggregate of feeling. So there's a pleasant, unpleasant, neutral associated with every sensory experience. Even if you don't see it, it's there. There are mental formations, the sankharas, that are arising with that as well. And then there's perceptions. So I have a simple example down here that, you know, once again, the eye sees the bowl. There's a seeing, this whole thing is contact, and co-arising with that is a feeling of pleasant. So if you look at this, maybe you have a feeling of pleasant. It could be unpleasant, you know, it depends on your conditions. Then there's a thought, for example, I want that bowl, or that bowl is ugly, or where did Laura get that bowl? There could be any number of formations that occur. And then there's a labeling that happens, bowl, maybe brown, maybe beautiful, just some simple way the mind frames that. So this is all occurring in an instant of time.
Sure. Can you clarify, what are the five aggregates again?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I have them here, but they're on the handout. But so the five aggregates, there's form, and that's the physical elements. There's feeling. I'll just write them out because they really figure heavily into the Abhidhamma, the way it develops. And they're on here too. So there's form, there's feeling, perceptions, and formations. Sometimes this formation, this is a, the Pali word here is sankhara. And that's how, it's been hard to translate into English. We'll talk about that in a minute. And then consciousness. So those are the consciousness. Those are the five aggregates. And this word sankhara, one of the 5-day study retreats that I went on, the first one I went with Andrew Linsky back east, was a whole week on sankharas, just teasing apart what that word means and how it has evolved. But one other way, there's many ways to translate that word. I'm just using formations here because that's what Bhikkhu Bodhi uses, but some people call it concoctions or fabrications. It's basically what we make up with our mind, how we fill in meaning, you know, from this other raw elements that we have here, from the five aggregates, how we take this, the consciousness of something and a feeling and a perception, and how we make a story about it, how we can concoct our experience.
And then form is physical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so back to this diagram, the form here would be
the eye
and the object that it sees. Okay, and but if this is the mind and the thought that it thinks, that wouldn't be form. I mean, you need to have the form of the body to have a mind, to have thoughts and mental consciousness. So, now these circles represent that whole complex of that triad of object, organ, consciousness, and then the other aggregates that arise, the feeling, the perception, and the formations. Oh, citta, that's consciousness.
Yeah,
so those are in the Abhidhamma system. So now we're kind of just getting back to our Abhidhamma system. Citta is a mind moment, basically, consciousness, a moment of consciousness. That's the Pali term there, that kind of did a little switch on you there. So those are discrete mind moments arising and passing away in the course of time.
So we established earlier that awareness and consciousness that are not the same thing, because there can be consciousness that arises without awareness.
Yeah, so consciousness in this sense of the word has degrees of awareness to it, and what we're aware of, you know, varies. Like if we're meditating, we're very quiet, we're aware of more of our consciousness, but there's all this happening oftentimes in the background that we aren't aware of. And it really influences us, and in turn is influenced by our karma. We'll get into that in a little bit.
I think there might be sometimes a mistake about thinking consciousness in terms of the Western word of consciousness being this being that has some awareness kind of thing, as opposed to consciousness that's being talked about here is discrete, like my consciousness, is that awareness that happens with this organ. So that there's different consciousnesses that we're talking about. It's not consciousness in terms of this, you know, somebody who is understanding it.
It's like a recognition.
Yeah.
Well, like when we talk about bringing our awareness somewhere, that's kind of like bringing the mind. That like bringing the mind, like if I want to bring my awareness to what I'm seeing, then am I bringing my mind, the mind consciousness to what's happening, the eye consciousness?
Yeah, no, that's right. What we're doing when we meditate is we're saying, okay, now I'm going to deliberately pay attention to what's happening. I'm going to be aware of the consciousness that's arising in my mind, and I'm going to do it in a way where I might be noting it. You know, you could be noting, you know, pain or sound or breath or what, you know, whatever label you want to put on it. But you're doing it in a way that things are known, and then they're known in the sense that they're arising and passing away. Okay, the sensation in the body that might be racking pain kind of has a whole trajectory, an arc of this existence of rising and passing away, and then something else in the next moment. So the meditation process is one of becoming more... Yeah, again, it's hard to use consciousness. We kind of use the Western English sense of it, but it's a development of the awareness of the consciousness that we have in each moment. A lot of these consciousnesses we aren't really conscious of. They're below the radar screen. There's so much happening in any given moment. The majority of it's below our radar screen, and we just focus on key features of what we like and we don't like. The first one thing is usually the determining factor of what we pay attention to. So here's how we this kind of gets into karma and how we get into how we get into trouble, how we create suffering for ourselves and others. So here's our same little moment of experience. And this kind of blows up the formations a little bit more. So the formation, what we're calling formations here, have different elements. It has an element of attention, and it has an element of doing. The word sankhara here, the ka here, means constructing or making. So there's an action that's happening there. And then there's a residue that is put down, that there's, from a Buddhist sense, there's a karmic residue that's laid down. So for each mind moment, whether that's a thought or one of these sensations or an action with the body, where we actually do something with the body, for each mind moment, there's a formation, and that formation will have the flavor of the term is kusala. There's different ways you can use translate the words wholesome, skillful, healthy. Good. You can even use good and bad if you wanted to, but I like this terminology, skillful or unskillful, and then there's a certain class of things that are neutral. So every thought we think in this model has associated with it one of these modalities that it's either skillful or unskillful or neutral. And this, I mentioned that one of the early English translators, Carolyn Rhys Davids, she called the Abhidhamma the psychological ethics, Buddhist psychological ethics. And this is where the ethics get in. It's an ethic. It's not like there's some overlord or some, deity who's kind of meeting out our retribution or rewarding us. But it's, based on our actions, we create conditions, the rising and passing of conditions that lead to benefit or harm, and then what we do with our minds and our bodies creates, if you will, a legacy, this karma, that then influences us and others at a later time. That's kind of a very rudimentary...
Can I ask, are only the formations, in a sense, the formations are the items that can be skillful and joyous, unskillful? Feelings and perceptions, and they also be skillful, neutral, or unskillful?
Well, the way I drew this is a little bit skewed, so probably it'd be better if I had these arrows connected with this whole complex here.
Oh, so feelings and perceptions also can have those.
Well, it's all embedded. They're all connected in one.
They're entangled, so you can't just separate one.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So, I just wanted to make sure I was perceiving that. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. That's a very good question here. That this diagram is constantly being updated and modeled, because it's hard to put all of this into words, let alone figures and arrows on all of this. So this is a work in progress. Did you have a question?
No.
So then you can, if you want to do you can put colors in And so our stream of consciousness is basically colored, if you will, by skillful and unskillful and sort of neutral thoughts, mental states. And, you know, we've all been in a situation where we're running in the red, right? You know, we're angry, you know, we get cut off in traffic and we're just boiling, you know, this person, don't they know? And, you know, and we all know what that's like to be out of there. Well, that's, you know, everything's red here, pretty much. Or we could be doing some mindfulness, be really mindful of our breath, or doing some loving kindness practice, or, you know, being compassionate towards someone, and we can be, you know, predominantly in the green here. Or we could have it neutral. And what can happen, you know, with practice, what we do is we learn to identify when we're in the red and nip it in the bud. And we also learn to cultivate the green. So that, for example, we're in that, in the traffic, we get cut off, and immediately the mind goes to the stories and the anger, and then within, you know, a second, the time gets much shorter. It's like, oh, anger. This is, you know, I'm focusing on a certain aspect of my experience, and this is not reality. And then we can flip it, for example, by saying some loving kindness, you know, maybe be safe, or maybe we could have a replace it with another thought, you know. There's different strategies to get out of the aversive mind state. But this all comes under the Noble Eightfold Path of right effort, you know, basically recognizing unskillful states and diminishing them or preventing them from arising, and recognizing skillful ones and cultivating them.
What do you track down those strategies?
Track them down.
Oh. Yeah, where do I find them? Where do I read about them? Where do I say?
A lot of different places. I mean, there's one sutta that talks specifically about mental, how it is called. In English, it's the Sutta on Discursive Thoughts, of how to deal with this. It's in this book, Majjhima Nikaya 20. But there's a lot of places where you learn, I mean, the whole Eightfold Path is basically learning strategies to deal with it. But there's specifically five different strategies for this. You know, the basic instruction is use mindfulness, right? Be aware of what's happening. So if your mind's anger, you might use, the breath might be your barometer, your radar system. Like, okay, I'm breathing shallow, so what does that mean? It means I'm angry, you know, or when I'm angry, you kind of have, you know, some warning signs of, you get skin's flush, maybe the palms are sweaty, I find my shoulders are tensing up, you know, there's just all of these. So that's the basic instruction of mindfulness. And then if that doesn't work, there's other, and you recognize it, you know, the big part of this is recognizing that, you know, you're in the red and not in the green. Once that's the case, you can do things like substitute. You know, you can substitute a wholesome or skillful mind state for an unskillful one. You can use things like loving kindness as a, you know, be an example of that. You can get actually not philosophical, but intellectual about it. Say, okay, this is an unskillful mind state, and I'm feeling it in the body, and this is not helpful, and this is not where I want to go. So you can kind of talk yourself out of it. The very last way that Buddha talked about was gets this image of a strong man grasping a weaker man and just pushing it down. So using your mind to suppress it. I don't know if I really related to that when I heard it, because there's been times, you know, with various addictions where I just, you know, I knew it was unhealthy. I knew, you know, it was just a cause of conditions. I tried substituting, that didn't work. I tried all the skills, and then in the end, what it just did was just, you know, that kind of just say no. But, you know, what was that, Nancy Reagan? He moved up. That just like, no, I'm not going to go to that conversation or that addiction or whatever it is again. I'm going to. So that's kind of the last straw. So there's a whole range of strategies that you can learn to, but practice in itself builds up this muscle. So with practice, and I'm not talking about being awakened, I'm talking about just what we do here, is we are pruning the red ones and encouraging the green ones, and basically reshaping our mind, rewiring our circuitry to recognize unskillful states and to encourage unskillful ones. And the way we do that is by repetition, you know, by practice. And if we're on a course of practice where we, you know, we sit down on the cushion and we have this great fantasy, you know, and we're just kind of lost in that, then that's what we're that's the muscle we're building. But if we're meditating and we get into that fantasy because it's natural, right? And we recognize, okay, I'm having a fantasy, this is not helpful, I'm going to go back to the breath and we can do concentration practice on the breath, or I'm going to say some loving kindness, or I'm going to open my awareness out to my body and feel sensations and, you know, have that kind of internal dialogue to change that unskillful state and make it a skillful one. So, okay.
Hey, did you drop that parchment?
No, that was in the UI.
So, did the last name was part of the name?
Yeah, you know, I never looked that up. That's not me. That must be the author of it. But I don't have artistic talents. So, that's, I should look up that. I just, something I downloaded off the internet, you know, looking for my little cartoons for my Dharma talks. Okay. I think it's time to go to the handouts and look at some of these factors. So that was the rough elements of the Dharma practice, of the Dharma theory of seeing experience in terms of discrete mind moments. And now we get into further level of depth, right? That those little circles represented those five things happening, the five aggregates. Now we're going to go into even further resolution, further details of what happens in any given mind moment. And I think what we should do maybe is start with the paper that says consciousness up in the right hand corner, Chitta. So remember we had our 82 different dhammas. The first one was Chitta, or consciousness. And then we have 52 mental factors, that's on the back side of the page, and 28 material factors called material phenomena, form factors, that's on the, also on the back of the page, and then Nibbana was the fourth Dhamma. And under the first Dhamma, consciousness, that I said there were 89 subtypes, well these are the 89 subtypes. And you know, I don't want to get too caught up in all of the details here, but basically, they're in this first category that produces unwholesome karma. So these are states of consciousness, mind moments, if you will, that number one is rooted in greed. There's a mental pleasure associated with it. It's based on wrong view and it's unprompted. And I'll give some examples of what those are in a minute. And so if you go down each of those, there's some slight variations on the theme, right? The first eight are all based on greed. So we know the mind state of greed. You know, we're caught up in wanting something, having desire, whether that's lust or wanting to appear a certain way to others or to some sort of material gain. We know what that is. And these are different ways of framing greed. With these different qualities, and I'll give some examples in a minute. And then the next two, 9 and 10, are hatred, or aversion. You know, there's an aversion in the mind. And then the next two are rooted in delusion. I'm going to read the examples from this book here that Bhikkhu Bodhi gives examples of these eight types, the first eight types. So he says that the first one, greed rooted with mental pleasure, wrong view, and unprompted, he calls it with joy, holding the view that there is no evil or wrong in stealing, the boy spontaneously steals an apple from a fruit stall. So that's the unprompted. So he, you know, walking by a fruit stall and you see that piece of fruit and you slip it into the pocket. So that's number one. Now, number two is the same scenario. He steals the apple from a fruit stand, but he's prompted by his friend. His friend says, hey, you know, I should steal that apple from the fruit stand for me. So that's prompted versus unprompted. And three or four, is the same as one and two, but there it's without wrong view. So here, he doesn't have a wrong view. So basically, he's just doing it out of ignorance. He doesn't have a wrong view that stealing is okay. He may have the view stealing is not skillful, is unskillful. So he has the view that it's unskillful, but he goes ahead and steals it anyway. And I think we can relate to that. I mean, this is kind of a big turning point of Dharma practice, is let's say we're working on addiction or, you know, an area in our life that we constantly struggle with, and as we meditate and practice, we kind of see, yeah, this is really causing a lot of harm, you know, we're reflecting on it, and yet I keep doing it, I keep falling into that same trap, and then over time, you just get to the point where, you know, you can't basically do it anymore, but he's at the stage, our boy here is at the stage where he knows it's wrong, but he's doing it anyways.
How fixed are the translations, unprompted and prompted? Because reading these through almost seems like it would be more likely spontaneous or premeditated.
Yeah, that's a very good point you raised there. In fact, you could say that with any of these, they could be spontaneous or premeditated. Because remember, from our model, everything is influenced. You know, none of these are actions that arise in a vacuum. There's, you know, this is the whole concept of karma, is that we have all of this preconditioning to each moment. And so whether we meditate on it or if it just, you know, it's just the spur of the moment thing, we're still acting unskillfully. So I think for the unprompted versus prompted, in terms of meditate, so you're thinking maybe those...
I only ask because, you know, it sounds interesting that one would be prompting from another when often things are... We've given some thought to something before we act on it.
Prompted internally, maybe.
Yes, internal prompting.
Yeah, I think it can be either way, internal or external prompting. But there's some trigger for doing that particular act. So in the first one where the boy is just walking by and he grabs the apple, he probably, you know, just a spur of the moment thought. There was no premeditation there. But it was based on, you know, his unskillful karma. And in the second one, I don't know if his, like if there wasn't a friend, if there was some like, you know, angel on his shoulder, some voice in him that says, oh yeah, I'm going to steal an apple today from the apple stand, if that's him self-prompting. I don't know, that's a good point.
Actually, I think that would then be, you know, whether Hiri and Otapa are present. So I think that's a different animal.
Yeah. Actually, we're going to see those two factors in a minute here.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, so we have the boy stealing the apple, prompted by a friend. Then three and four were the same as one and two, except for he doesn't hold wrong view, so he knows stealing is not. Skillful. Five and eight are similar to one through four, except the stealing is done with a neutral feeling. So he gains no pleasure from stealing, and the same token, he doesn't have any aversion, you know, doesn't have any displeasure with it. So those are all the green-rooted ones. So they're using the word with mental pleasure for the first four and with equanimity for the second four. Equanimity is a state of mind that's balanced, that there's neither desire or aversion in the moment. So number nine, I'm getting into the hatred rooted, and this Bhikkhu Bodhi's example is, with hatred, one man murders another in a spontaneous fit of rage. So that is the hatred with mental displeasure, because he's got rage in his mind. There's aversion, and it's unprompted. And then 10, which is prompted, this answers your question. With hatred, one man murders another after premeditation. So in the first one, he's prompted. He is prompted in a spontaneous fit of rage. In the second, he premeditates it. Unprompted was spontaneous, and prompted was premeditated. Yeah. And then the delusion ones, 11 and 12, a person due to delusion doubts that the enlightenment of the Buddha or the efficacy of the Dhamma is a way to deliverance. So that's delusion with equanimity and with doubt. So that, you know, that's basically the hindrance of doubt, you know, when we're meditating, we're kind of sitting there thinking, you know, why am I doing this? Wasting my time? It could be, you know, a yoga class, or, you know, that's not yoga, I do yoga. But, you know, I could be doing something else. I could be doing Sufi dancing or some other practice other than their meditation. You know, that's just the mental hindrance of doubt that's arising, not personal. And then number 12, the final one, a person is so distracted in mind that she cannot focus her mind on any object. So that's delusion, rooted with equanimity and with restlessness. So that's just a subtle difference there. Doubt in the first case, in the second case, distraction or restlessness. And you can go through each one of these and come up with examples. I will say, if you get to 55, so the first box, 1 through 54, there are different spheres, or sometimes you hear them called realms of the mind in Buddhism. And there's the sense sphere realm, sense realm. There's the form realm, formless realm, and then super mundane here. So those four realms. And in Buddhist cosmology, they track to the different levels of heavens and hell. Hells. So there's this whole kind of Buddhist cosmology out there. But in terms of the mind, the sense spheres are basically states of consciousness that are based on the six senses, whereas the form sphere are based on the first four jhanas. Now, there's a little, some of you will notice that there's a fifth jhana, number 59, and in the Abhidhamma system, the first four jhanas, this gets really kind of esoteric and maybe not worth your time even talking about, are expanded to the fifth jhana, to five jhanas. So some people consider there's eight jhanas, there's the form jhanas, 1 through 4, and then after you get to the what would be the fifth, sixth, and seventh jhanas, in the, you know, the sutta view of jhanas, these are the formless realms, and they're 70 through 73. There's the sphere of infinite space, the sphere of infinite consciousness, the sphere of nothingness, and the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. And these are just very rarefied states of concentration that the mind can be in. And all this, you know, I don't think we need to perseverate on that, but all this says is that beyond our ordinary realm of mind of, you know, stealing the apple, and there's wholesome ones here too, I'll get to in a minute. Beyond that, there's these higher states of consciousness that are based on a mind that has been purified to the point of very serene, calm concentration, and that has its own types of consciousness. And then you can take that to the form and the formless, and then the super mundane consciousness, the 82 through 89, those are various stages of awakening, of enlightenment of the mind. So the mind of somebody who has entered stream entry, is either on the way to stream entry or has achieved it. Path is on the way, fruit is, has achieved it. All the way up to Arahant ship, number 89, that would be the same as Nibbana. So those are a state of consciousness that, you know, again, I'm not qualified to talk about. Again, I can give you the historical view and speculations, but those have their own consciousness. Now, the other thing I wanted to point to here is the first category produces unwholesome karma. The second one is the result of past unwholesome karma. So in that prior diagram, what is neutral here is a mind moment, is a, one of these moments that does not produce karma, but receives karma from the past. And this gets, again, kind of esoteric and it can be hard to wrap the mind about, but not every one of these cheetahs produces karma. Some of them are the products of karma. And so there's this flow of, at each, you know, as time goes on, we're producing karma and we're experiencing the results of those karma. And this just breaks up the different categories of whether we're, it's producing it or it's the results of it. And the karma can be wholesome or unwholesome here.
So is that basically saying, like, if under number 13, if we were to see, like, an unpleasant sight or something, that would be... can you give an example of what that would mean?
Well, yeah, I would say it probably, let's say number 13, unwholesome resultant with equanimity, eye consciousness. So yeah, that we're seeing something, and Lori mentioned this earlier, the mind is colored by our experience. So in the prior mind moments, there's been anger, for example. I don't know if this one has equanimity, though. So it wouldn't be anger, it would be delusion. But so we're seeing something with the eye that's, and we're not seeing it correctly. We have equanimity about it, so it's not causing either aversion or greed. But we have equanimity about it through the eye door, but it's unwholesome because we have delusion about it. That would be an example. And that and it comes about as a result of us, of our prior actions. You know, our mind has been cultivated, or you could say miscultivated, by not, you know, seeing things as they really are. What else do I want to say? One thing, so 1 through 19 are unwholesome, and 31 through 46 are wholesome. So the good news is there's a lot more wholesome mind states than there are unwholesome. I focus on the good thing. Functional is the next two categories, functional for all, you know, and then there's functional arahants only. It sounds like an exclusive club. But there are mind states that are believed to be with awakening that are, you know, specific to that, and you can imagine why that would be. But functional is not rooted in a karma, basically. And these terms, five-door averting and mind-door averting, we might get to that a little bit when we look at the 17 mind moments later. I think that's all I want to say about the consciousness at this point, because we'll backfill it in a minute when we look at the mental factors making up each one of those consciousnesses. But if there's a question or comment on anything.
These are a translation it's smile producing.
Uh-huh.
You know, compared to mind door.
Well, where that's,
you know, it's like it's interesting how it's translated.
Yeah, the smile producing is a whole interesting phenomenon in Buddhism. There's some suttas that are recorded where the Buddha would be walking through a particular area, and he'd have a smile on his face, and then usually his sidekick, Ananda, would, you know, speculate what the smile meant, or the sutta would go on to say why he smiled. Like, and a lot of times the smile would be because the Buddha saw, like, you know, eons ago in that particular place there was a village, and, you know, this happened, you know, like something that has to do with the Buddha's ability to see things that are, you know, beyond the normal sensory perception. And, you know, he would have a Buddha, I mean, some of our Buddhists smile, and that's, so there's this whole culture that grew up around the Buddha's smile and smile producing.
Well, we have, a lot of this whole smile thing. Remember the little round, I guess you call them little icons with the little smiley face? That's like, you know, people believe that if you saw that little circle, you know, they look like your little circle staring ring with the smiley face in it. People think that that's smile producing. So, you know.
Yeah, it is. Well, yeah, and they have this whole positive psychology James Perez, who's also one of the Spirit Rocks teachers, has a course on awakening joy. You know, he fought his own depression and, you know, was a very strong meditation practitioner and couldn't use his conventional training to get out of his deep states of depression he was in. And he said that he turned towards psychology and also Buddhism to come up with this, you know, awakening joy, which really has a lot to do with training the mind to recognize joy and happiness and then to cultivate it specifically using meditation and other tools. And that would be also another example of how to switch the red to green, you know.
Whoops.
James Barraz, B-A-R-A-Z, and he has an online course out of Berkeley called Awakening Joy. He's written a book on it, and there's websites and a lot of materials out there. But it combines Buddhist meditative practice with what would it be called, positive psychology. You know, there's this whole field now, separate from Buddhism, that of positive psychology, and there's books written on that. There's going to be research being done on how, you know, we can basically create the conditions of the mind. You know, we have some choice in that, you know, and how to cultivate that in particular. All right. Anything else before we flip the page?
Really, just really quick. So, result of past unwholesome karma, 17. Unwholesome result with physical pain, body, consciousness. So, because all the others say equanimity. So, what I'm trying to understand is putting this to a personal experience, trying to. Okay, so. I have a mind state. Can this be used for mind state? That particular 117, I have a mind state. It's causing me discomfort in the body, and it's resulting past unwholesome actions. So,
yeah, I think that's spot on. I mean, one way you could frame that, that's a great, I didn't think of that, but it's a great example. You're meditating and you're maybe remembering a difficult argument with your boss or whoever, and while you're doing that, you've got this kind of knot arising in the shoulder, you know, or you know, some people kind of tighten their jaw muscles and then you feel the pain. So I would think that would be an example of that, and that's why that one, since it's body consciousness, you actually have a physical pain associated with it.
Yeah, and actually in the suttas, as I understand classically, the other sense doors actually have neutral feeling.
Yeah.
And when we are not, aware, we're not in a wholesome mind state, neutral tends towards unpleasant. And the well-instructed worldling practicing who understands neutral then experiences neutral pleasant. But all of the eye, ear, nose, tongue, those doors are supposed to be all neutral feeling tone. It's only the body that actually, classically, they say that's the only place where you experience painful or pleasant feeling tone.
Yeah, I think that's why these all have equanimity except for the body.
All right, there you go.
It's neutral.
But the ignorant person experiences equanimity as unpleasant.
Interesting. Yeah, there's a lot of little subtle points from this table that you can tease apart, you know, and we're, how it maps with meditation is, you know, we can have these theories that we've been theorizing on here, and then we can experience it and say, oh yeah, that is my experience, the body consciousness of an unwholesome resultant. Not always, but I think that's can be the advantage of this map, Abhidhamma that we're looking at. So, let's dig in a little deeper. Now, the second category of dhammas are mental factors. the other side of that page, and there's 52 mental factors, and those come in different flavors. There's what we have, ethically variable, then we have unwholesome, and they use the word beautiful here, but you could also use wholesome factors there. And for each category of the ethically variable, the unwholesome and the wholesome, there's what's called universals and occasionals. So the universals mean that in any mind moment, those have to be there. So the first seven are present in any mind moment. Contact, we are, that's the same contact we had in our little triangles when those three meet, that's contact. Feeling, we know that one. Perception, we know that one. Now, volition, chetana, that, another word for that is intention. And that's a factor of mind, a quality of mind of doing, of intending to do something. And that's very important to see that in each moment, mind moment, there is some intention. We may be ignorant of that intention, but this is, you know, really the root of karma, is that there is some intention in each moment. Number four. There's one pointedness, and what that is, ikagata, which basically means that in any given moment of consciousness, there has to be some gathering of mind or some collection or awareness, you know, concentration would be another way of putting it, on that particular sense object, you know, that there's a one pointedness of mind at that particular moment. Life faculty, that, you know, one way to understand that is that, and it's kind of intuitive in all of this, is that, you know, we're talking about living entities, the human mind in this case, which has a life faculty. So a rock would not have a moment of consciousness. Actually, there were schools in India that believed, and I guess still do, that there is life faculty present in all matter, but I think Buddhism would say that there's only life faculty present in living things, trees, and animals, etc. And then attention, there's got to be some awareness or attention present, number seven, in each moment. Now, then we come to six occasional factors, 8 through 13. So these may or may not be present in any moment. And then we have vitakka and vichara, that's the initial application of mind, sustained application. There's decision, energy. Iti sometimes translated as joy or rapture. But it's basically a kind of a slight pleasure of the mind. And the desire is chanda can be both skillful or unskillful, so we can have a desire to do something skillful, and then, you know, from a Buddhist sense, that would be a skillful desire. Or we can have a desire for, you know, causing harm or being, you know, caught up in greed, the, you know, conventional sense of what we mean by desire.
So, question about manasikara versus vitakka vichara. My understanding of manasikara has some sense of investigation or not?
Yeah, I think that's one aspect of it, definitely, that the manasikara is seeing things, having, there's manasikara is usually spoken of in the suttas in terms of a yoniso and a yoniso, so, and that's translated into English as wise attention or unwise attention. So from a Buddhist perspective, if we are under the delusion that we're permanent, that, you know, we're not under suffering, and that we, that there's a self, then that's unwise attention. But if we understand things as they truly are, and sometimes you hear that phrase, then that's wise attention. So yeah, I guess investigation or seeing things clearly. Another term that's used around this is sampajana,
yeah.
Clear comprehension. So you're comprehending things clearly, you're understanding them as they truly are. Whereas the vitakka and vichara just has to do with the mind moving out or moving towards something. So if you, let's say you look at this thing, and the mind, I don't know if that's going to work, basically, You know, and these are jhana factors too.
Right,
things,
because
so.
I'm wondering, you know, because usually in vitakka there's an initial application of the attention on an object.
Yes.
And then vichara is a sustained application of that attention on the object. But what you're saying is seven is already present.
It has
attention
to be present.
Is present, but maybe it's not conscious attention. So then eight and nine then make sense because there's actually an intentional awareness of the attention.
Yes, I think that's correct. It's kind of hard to, I don't know enough to really speculate further. I know that, for example, when we are meditating, you know, just separate from this, their presence here,
right.
Mind you, this is the Abhidhamma, which is a model of how those factors fit in, but when we're meditating and we initially, you know, say, okay, I'm going to put my awareness on the breath, that's vitakka, and we keep the mind on the breath, that's vichara, that's the sustained application, so we're coming back over and over again to keep the awareness on the breath. Okay, so those are the ethically variable. Now we get into the unwholesome, and you know, a lot of these we know, there's delusion, which, you know, in every unwholesome moment, there's got to be delusion, shamelessness, fearlessness, and restlessness. All four of those are present anytime we have a unskillful or also known as unwholesome mind moment. And then there could be any number of these 10, 18 through 27 occasional factors. You could probably think of different mindsets. I'm going to show a graphic illustration of one of them in a graphic, not hideous or anything, but, you know, with a little chart there from Andrew Linsky. And then the beautiful factors are the skillful ones. There are, you know, this huge number, 19 universal factors that are present. So in any wholesome mind state, you have at least seven ethically variable universals, and then 19 additional beautiful universals. So what is that, seven? That's 26. You have at least 26 mental factors in any wholesome mind moments, and then there can be occasional ones too. And some of these we know, faith, mindfulness is there. We had the opposites of Hiri and Utapa over on 16 and 17. Then we had the opposites of greed and hatred. Now, 34, neutrality of mind, tapta majja tapta, that's also equanimity. So that's interesting to know that there's an element of equanimity. And you can kind of look at this as a soundboard. The mind's a soundboard. So there's 52 knobs. And in any given moment, what gain is turned up on which knobs, and that'll tell you what mental state you have in that particular moment. So you have at least the first seven knobs. You know, these soundboards. You've seen some of the really fancy ones, the mixers, the DJs and whatnot. I don't know how they work, but you can imagine, you know, turning up the gain on at least the first seven universals and then some combination to get a particular sound quality.
They're really, the soundboards really use, I'm missing something here. There is a soundboard that produces these.
I was just using it as an example.
A visual aid.
Just another way of, you know.
I mean, never know what yoga is and meditation promoters are going to come up.
Well, and maybe
plays music that creates shame or something.
Vibrates at a certain resonance.
Well, maybe that's how the Abhidhammas practice with this, is they say, oh, I know how to strengthen, you know, mindfulness and faith and, you know, all of these factors. I know how to do that with my mind to get a particular result. I don't know, but that would be, you know, that'd be pretty awesome.
And Jeff, it might be useful to explain Hiri, because some people, when you see the word shame, and they may equate shame with guilt, and that's not that type of shame. The Hiri that's talked about here as a beautiful factor is the idea of like having a conscience. But it's not the sense of the Western kind of idea of shame with guilt and remorse and all that other stuff. But it's more like having a conscience that keeps you on the straight and narrow.
Yeah, that's great.
That shame is not, you know, because sometimes people pick that up and they think, oh, you know, shame. Oh.
Yeah, thank you for that. These are again, a lot of these Pali terms are hard to translate. These are Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations, and I'm trying to think of some of the other translations of Piri. You know, one way of looking at Piri was
one's moral dread and moral.
Yeah, those are problems. Those are another
kind of nasty
but
too.
Basically, you can look at the two as self-respect. You know,
yeah.
I have self-respect for, you know, the kind of behaviors I engage in, and then that's the first one here. You know, tapa is the respect of others. You know, that I have some social conscience here. They call that fearlessness of wrong, but that's, you know, that's kind of the respect of others there.
Right.
Thank you.
So an unhealthy shame binds us to the unwholesome action, where a healthy shame, we recognize an unwholesome action, but we are free from the persecution that an unhealthy shame would bind. You know, we're free to make a better choice in the next moment. But I'm saying it would seem like what you just described as an unhealthy shame is just something that binds us to an action and identifies us with that action, identifies the action to the as a permanent, as
yeah, it's a form of clinging. You know, there's the shame of I use the word self-respect, so it would, you know, I guess what you're calling an unhealthy shame or unskillful would be basically, you know, I have this image of myself and I'm really clinging to that image that, you know, oh, I am a good person, I did something wrong, and therefore now I'm a bad person, you know, that kind of clinging to an identity there, maybe is what you're calling unhealthy shame. Now, by this model, though, shame is a universal, beautiful factor. So, this quality can't have clinging in it. That would be a different quality if there was that sense of identity or you're clinging to it. Now, as a stepping stone, though, in practice, I think, you know, the Buddha taught that even unhealthy shame can be beneficial, to have this kind of horror of doing, you know, and this is where kind of the entry level precepts begin. You know, like, you know, killing, you know, to develop this, you know, maybe even clinging around it. If somebody's a killer, you know, and they're used to killing, you know, I grew up in a family of hunters, you know, so I shot small animals when I was growing up. And then at some point, you know, I developed this moral kind of sense of dread, you know, that this is, you know, this is really not Buddhist, and, you know, this is, you know, going to lead to bad karma and whatever. So I have this kind of clinging around, this is a bad thing. That was a bridge to where I'm now. It's to me, it's just more natural that killing doesn't make sense. It's just, you know, it's not logical. It's, you know, it's just less in my repertoire. I wouldn't say it's completely eradicated in my mind, but, you know, it's just something that I'm so far removed from now that it's, you know, I think it's more of a healthy, more of a true hearing than rather, you know, this kind of fear of, you know, breaking some precept.
Okay, so using that model that you just gave me, that example, excuse me, an unhealthy shame, which still cling to those past behaviors as identifying, well, geez, never mind. Because just identifying yourself as a good person is clinging too, so.
Yeah, in fact,
yeah.
If you look under unwholesome factors, we have mana. And that's the whole thing of
identifying.
I can see it would mean that I am not.
Conceit
means comparing, period, in any way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
And whether you have
better than or worse than or equal.
Right.
If you have it in your mind at that time, then it's an unwholesome mind state.
Are you going to get into some of these other ones and explain them, like, goodness?
Luminous. You know, I don't really understand those as well.
It has to do with the ability of the mind to be used.
Okay.
You know, so the malleability, the wieldiness of the mind is the ability for the mind to actually be used as a tool. You know, so we do all of these practices like concentration, etc., and the thing is we're training the mind. And at some point, the mind becomes wieldy and malleable. So it's able to change and it's able to be used for a purpose.
Oh, gratitude.
Yeah. I don't know. So this group of words, I think were evolved from the old fine sutta passages Lauren was just talking about them, where someone will have gone through the jhanas and their mind will be all of these things. They'll be light and malleable and wieldy. Proficiency is sometimes translated differently. And rectitude generally means upright, upstanding, proper. It has a moral quality to it. We see it elsewhere. It's a word that's used in the Metta Sutta and a couple of places. So it's kind of like this uprightedness, I will say, of mind. And I forgot why there's two for each of those. What was that?
Might be a quality.
Oh, yeah. One of them is of the mental. This gets really kind of esoteric, but one of them is the mental body and one is of consciousness. So there's this whole thing of the kaya citta, the mind made body versus consciousness. So
that's 34 and 35.
All those see.
Now the ones that have two.
That have two numbers.
Oh, okay.
There's two versions of that. So it gets a little bit beyond my ability to explain it. But, or understand it. And then the occasionals. So the first three, right speech, right action, right livelihood, are. What are those? Those are factors from, we've seen them before, we didn't talk about them. We talked about indirectly today. Yeah, those are on the Noble Eightfold Path, and they're particularly under the category of sila, which is ethical conduct. And so those are occasionals. You might not have those present in each moment. And then the last, in 50 and 51, karuna and mudita, and what are those?
From the harvest.
Yeah, they're the Brahma Viharas. And it's interesting, it's said that in any given mind state, you can't have both of them. You can only have one or the other. I don't know why that is, but that's one of the kind of rules that come out of the system. And then number 52, the kind of the linchpin of the whole system, the ultimate purpose of practice is to gain wisdom, you know, to have insight into things and to have the wisdom. And that's only occasionally present. There's not wisdom's not even in all of the wholesome mind states, the beautiful mind states, wisdom is an occasional. It's a very, you know, it's not always present there in any given moment. Of the Brahma Viharas, some people might ask, well, there's only two of them there, but the others exist here too.
32, 33.
So yeah, so 32, non-greed, aloha, that's the synonym for loving kindness.
Or non-hatred, actually, 33.
Yeah, sorry, you're right. Loving kindness is non-hatred, adosa. And 34, equanimity, neutrality of mind. So all four of the Brahma Viharas are present, are in the beautiful factors, and two of them are always present. So that's interesting, right? In every wholesome mind state, there will be both loving kindness and equanimity.
Can I ask another stupid question?
Yeah.
This one's probably going to be stupid because I probably already know the answer, but I got to ask it anyway. So 14 through 52, this seems really like really important stuff. All of this. Is there basically this is spread throughout Buddhism, or is there any particular source where this would be
for present. Non-Buddhist source where they, these terms are, or these concepts?
No, he's asking like for a source if he wanted to learn about them.
So, you know, what these are really are terms from the suttas. So they're present in a lot of other teachings in different formats. And what the Abhidhammas did is they said, okay, let's sit down and look at the mind. And we've got all these terms that the Buddha threw at us, and we have a sense of what they are. Let's recreate them in the, you know, the laboratory of the mind. Let's really see, in any given moment, I have this thought, what is there, what's present? Well, I got a little bit of this, and some of that, some of that. So these are all part of the teachings, and you can find particular suttas or, you know, I was, you know, probably some good sources of reading about these different factors. Now, none of them will have this exact list, because this is, you know, basically one of the goals of Abhidhamma was to coalesce, combine, and unify these different teachings into one system. But there are probably, you know, other than reading this book, there's probably more. I mean, these are all in this Abhidhamma book. And Bhikkhu Bodhi does a pretty good job at explaining them and using the commentarial form for each of these factors. He says, he defines the four states like, what is the characteristic, what is it, causes it, you know, what's the proximate cause of these things, so he goes into some detail. But there's a number of books that describe different aspects of this, you know, describe how the mind works, the Brahma Viharas, the different ethical factors. But this is the, you know, the Abhidhamma really provides it
It might be a simple...
Yeah, that's definitely a good book. You know, in Gil's book that she has in the back there, there's a number of these factors that are explained. Bhikkhu Bodhi has a book called In the Words of the Buddha, which is an anthology of suttas, and he'll go into great detail on many of these terms and how they're found in the suttas and what they mean.
It's interesting to note on here, you know, on the unwholesome factors, and this is, you know, this sometimes we underplay this in some of the teachings, but delusion is always present in any unwholesome mind state.
By necessity, yeah, exactly.
I probably should tell you, the reason I'm asking these questions is I work in a counseling setting with kids, and some of my kids are acting out, unable to control their own emotions or regulate their emotions. And if we could do 14, 15, 16, and 17, and work with the kids on that, we can help them predict when they're going to do something really stupid. So that's why I'm trying to get all this stuff from the book.
Yeah. Well, and another way of looking at it is, you know, if you can teach them to understand, to see the five hindrances, because these are all great, but that's kind of more of a user-friendly version of the different mental states, you know, whether you're caught up in, and they do this, you know, mindful schools, and there's different programs out there for working this with kids, you know, who have a little limited, less of a capacity maybe for the conceptual, cognitive piece and more, you know, intuitive, you know, in a way they got a leg up on this, right? Because they're more connected to their bodies and more intuitive with some of this stuff. We're more up in our heads. But the five hindrances, I think, are probably a little bit more, I don't want to use the word universal, but a little bit more user-friendly for that. So, you know, the recognizing when the mind's caught up in greed, when it's caught up in aversion, when there's a restlessness, when there's a sloth and torpor, and when there's doubt, and, you know, when it's in one of those states, and how they combine together to create, you know, unskillful actions. And to see that consequence, you know, that when I am feeling this way, I will say this thing or do this thing that has this unfavorable consequence. Hindrances, yeah. That's in all of these books, because it's very basic. And it's also meditator-friendly. It's, you know, when we're sitting down, how do you actually work with this. I think we should probably take a break. It's 3. we'll come back. We have one more discussion section, but why don't we'll spend the next maybe 40 minutes first walking and then sitting in any combination. So if you want to wander, walk, or longer just sit, it'll be self-propelled. And then I'll, in 40 minutes, I'll go outside and ring the bell for our final discussion section, where we'll tie it all together in a nice package and make it easy to understand.